1162.
Replace code chapter 16.40 pertaining to private for hire transportation in the city of Portland.
Commissioner Novick.
Mayor, sometimes Portland leads the nation. Other times, we, like any other jurisdiction, get dragged kicking and screaming into the future. This would fall into the latter category. As of about a year ago, we were being constantly pounded by the media and by TNC companies for not allowing in these TNCs or providing service to millions of people around the country and the world. And we made it clear, I think, that we were open to the idea of taking another look at the private for hire regulations, but we didn't want to rush it. There was a point where Uber did decide to rush it and come in and start breaking the law, and we told them that that was unacceptable, and they backed off. Since then, we've been engaged in a lengthy and thorough process of trying to determine what the new rules for this industry, for both taxis and TNCs, should be. And we've been very honored to have the advice of our citizen task force, which spent countless hours listening to testimony, doing research, deliberating, having back and forth with us to come up with their final recommendations. We are allowing for competition in the private for hire industry. We want to be sure that it is fair competition. So we are requiring both TNC companies and taxis to provide 24/7 citywide service. We're requiring TNC companies and taxis to provide service to people who need wheelchair-accessible vehicles. We are requiring criminal background checks for all drivers. We're requiring inspections for all vehicles. There are going to continue to be some differences between how we treat TNCs and how we treat taxis. We are going to allow taxis, but not TNCs, to take street hails. It won't be legal for somebody to just flag down an Uber or Lyft vehicle, only a taxi. There also will, under these proposed rules, continue to be some difference when it comes to insurance. Specifically, there's been a debate about what level of insurance should be required when a TNC driver's app is on, but before they've been asked to go give somebody a ride or be in the process of giving somebody a ride. People in the taxi industry have said that once the app is on, it's a commercial vehicle, and therefore they should have the same level of insurance as always required for taxis. I don't think that's an unreasonable argument. The counterargument, which has been accepted by numerous other jurisdictions, is that the period when the app is on but a ride has not been requested is sort of a period in between being a private automobile and being a commercial automobile, so a different level of insurance, higher than what's required of a normal driver but lower than what's required of a taxi cab, should be adopted. We spent a lot of time thinking about this issue, noting that a large number of other jurisdictions have taken this approach. We've talked to some people in the insurance industry who have said that they think that this approach is reasonable, but it's something that we should watch. That we should wait and see what data there is on the actual insurance claims data during that, quote, period one, and it might be something that gets reevaluated down the line. The Colorado Public Utilities Commission came to the same conclusion. This struck them as a reasonable way of doing insurance now for period one, but they want to look at data and maybe come to a different conclusion somewhere down the line. So this is an issue, insurance in period one, where we are continuing the rules in the pilot for now, but I want to bring a report to the council a year from now where we look at data from around this city and the country and see if it might be appropriate to revisit that. We've also made a commitment that we are going to analyze and bring a report at the end of next year on what the impact of lifting the cap on the total number of vehicles has been on both drivers and consumers, because that's a new thing. And some folks have asked, we take a look at what the effect of that has been, and I think that that's appropriate. One thing that I want to mention is that we have been monitoring the provision of service to everybody, and also we've been doing some monitoring, particularly of what's the level of service has been to people who need wheelchair accessible vehicles. What we've seen over the last few months is that nobody seems to truly provide 24/7 citywide wheelchair accessible vehicle service, but both taxis and TNCs have been making significant progress towards that in the past couple of months. There was a period in the beginning of the pilot when the TNCs acknowledged that they were actually not providing 24/7 citywide wheelchair accessible service. And I have asked PBOT staff and the city attorney to determine what penalties should be assessed against them for knowingly not complying with that requirement, which was there from the beginning. So that's something you should see in the next couple of weeks, I think, that we will say, you were subject to this requirement all along, we meant it, you acknowledge you were violating it, therefore you're going to have to pay penalties. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to either you, Mayor, or to
Commissioner Nova, directly take a question? Or
to yes.
So the penalties for the wave violation, that's in addition to what you have a penalty schedule in your proposed legislation for these violations going forward?
Yes.
Okay. And one of the issues, Steve, that you and I care deeply about is the terms of service agreements. And could you tell us where you landed on that?
Thank you, Commissioner. I appreciate your bringing that up because that is something where this is an issue that Commissioner Fish brought up, and I thought he was right. Looking at the TNCs, and I think it was particularly Uber's terms of service, it has language in there, you know, which is you have to click on before you get a ride. It has language to the effect of, no matter how negligent we are, we're not liable, and if we are liable, we're only liable for $500. That kind of blanket disclaimer for any misconduct is not valid in the state of Oregon. An Oregon Supreme Court decision came down last year that said that you can't have a disclaimer like that. However, somebody reading these terms of service might not know about that Oregon Supreme Court decision, so they might have a problem with the Uber and take a look at this language and say, oh, well, I guess I can't do anything because I gave up all my legal rights. So we said that we're going to insist, and we are insisting, that any such disclaimer of liability be followed by a statement that such disclaimers are not legal in Portland and normal tort laws apply, so that people who are injured will know that. And I thank Commissioner Fish very much for highlighting that issue.
Thank you. And also, my understanding is that Lyft has, in fact, agreed to comply with that requirement.
And they have said they will comply with it, and Uber has also acknowledged that it's the rule and they're going to have to comply with it.
Okay. Thank you.
And while I'm thanking my fellow commissioners, I should mention that one other concept we're adopting that was forwarded by another commissioner is that we're replacing a system of permit fees being assessed to annual permit fees being assessed to drivers and companies with having the cost of administering the TNC program, which includes monitoring performance and making sure that people are behaving legally and bringing enforcement actions. The cost of all of that activity will be paid for by, as per Commissioner Saltzman's suggestion, a per-trip charge, which we estimate will be between 40 and 50 cents per trip, which means that the customers will be paying for the oversight of this program, which I think is preferable to saying that the city taxpayers as a whole will be paying for the cost of the program, or for that matter, having individual drivers have to pay for the cost by annual permit fees. So this is an innovation for which I thank Commissioner Saltzman very much.
So let me call up Transportation Director Leah Treat, and then let me let everybody know how we're going to proceed this afternoon. You can come on up, Leah. I'm just going to walk through the procedure here. First of all, I just want to suspend the rules for a moment and welcome a delegation from Hirosaki, Japan, who are here studying our city. Welcome to Portland. And then, again, let everybody know how we're proceeding. This is a hearing. This is the first reading of the proposed regulations that Commissioner Novick has just summarized. We're not going to vote today. We'll vote in a subsequent council meeting, but this is the public hearing. Actually, it looks like November 18th is the day in which we'll have that vote. We, of course, have had several hearings on this subject since we first took it up in the spring. And it's very important that we hear from both sides of the issue today. So we have a couple of hours for testimony this afternoon. This hearing's going to end at 6 p.m., and we're going to make sure that we hear from people, again, who are on opposite, perhaps, sides of the question of whether these regulations have it right or not. So we're going to allow an hour of testimony for each point of view. I'm going to limit testimony to 2 minutes per person just because we have a very large number of people signed up to speak. And again, we'll be alternating between support and opposition. If for some reason we have it wrong about where you are on the issue, just check back in with our council clerk and we'll make sure she gets you in the queue. As always, we maintain the rules of decorum here. We'll occasionally suspend the rules and clap for somebody, particularly visitors or students, but we ask that in this kind of a hearing environment that you're certainly welcome to indicate your support or opposition for other points of view by giving them a thumbs up or a thumbs down or some other polite hand gesture, but we do not allow people to make demonstrations and clap for points of view here because we don't want people to feel intimidated. We want people to be able to come up and have their say, and whether they're popular or unpopular in the room, be able to do so, and I think each of us can understand why that's important. So with that, we have a presentation and some questions, and then any questions about the procedure?
Yeah, that was a question about the procedure. Right, when are we taking amendments?
Good question. I would say we should probably take them early.
So there's a staff presentation, maybe then amendments, and
is that okay
for
with
the
you, Commissioner
questions?
Novick? Would you rather hear amendments at the beginning or the end of the hearing?
I think the beginning is preferable.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm excused at 5 p.m. Okay. That's a hard 5 p.m., so
okay.
I'll be gone by then.
All right. Well, we'll be in the hearing phase at that point. So, okay, so Director Treat and others, why don't you make your presentation, then we'll take up amendments and then start hearing from people.
Great. Thank you very much, Commissioner, Mayor. I'm joined by Dave Benson and Mark Williams, fellow staff from PBOT. So across the country, we are seeing very rapid and far-reaching changes in how people are getting around, and Portland is no stranger to this trend. We have seen a very fast evolution of our private-for-hire transportation market. The number of private-for-hire options available to Portlanders has expanded, and we've seen an impressive growth in demand for private-for-hire service. The regulations that we are presenting today have been developed to shape this evolution and with two overarching goals in mind. The first is when Portlanders use private for hire transportation, we want them to be safe and we want the service to be reliable. Second, when private for hire companies and drivers operate in Portland, we want them to encounter a market that is fair and a market that is competitive. To achieve these goals, we have undertaken an extensive revision of Chapter 16. It's 153 pages, and there's more than 53,000 words of code there. So before I turn the presentation over to Mark and Dave, I want to highlight what has informed the new rules that are before you today. In January, we formed the Private for Hire Innovation Task Force. Task Force members contributed almost 700 hours of volunteer service and received input from a broad cross-section of stakeholders with interest in this program. They delivered their final recommendations in August, and I want to take this opportunity to thank the task force members for their service, the industry experts, and the Portlanders who participated in that process. All of those insights were very valuable to us and directly influenced the changes that are before you today. As an example, I'd like to highlight the new accessibility requirements. Working in collaboration with the task force and the Portland Commission on Disability, PBOT has developed new accessibility requirements to improve service and expand transportation options to people with disabilities, and specifically those needing wheelchair-accessible vehicles, otherwise known as WAVES. Those new requirements are rooted in service performance standards. And later in the presentation, Dave Benson, Joe Vandeveer, and Nicole Charon will explain them in more detail to you. It is also important to note the role that reliable data has played in helping shape the recommendations. In April, at the Council's direction, PBOT initiated a pilot program to expand taxi service and allow TNCs, transportation network companies, to operate. As part of this pilot program, we collected data on more than 1 million rides that Portlanders took during the first 4 months of the program. The information we received on trip durations, ride destinations, passenger wait times, wave rides, all of this has been invaluable. According to the data, we saw an incredible growth in ridership in just the first few months of the pilot. From May to August, taxi ridership did decline slightly at about 16%, but we saw overall ridership increased by 40%. The report also showed that taxi and TNC service improved throughout the city, and specifically in East Portland neighborhoods, where ridership increased by about 50%. Thanks to this data, we do understand the private-for-hire market in a much more comprehensive way, and this understanding has helped us focus on the regulatory changes. It is important to know that we are going to continue to collect data, and we will use it to inform any future regulatory decisions. And these regulations have also been informed by input that we have received from you, our City Council. Private for hire service is a key part of our transportation ecosystem. It is also one of the most innovative and dynamic parts of it. We believe that the proposed regulations will allow Portland to take full advantage of the innovation and ensure that public safety and fair competition are protected. Thank you very much for the opportunity to provide opening remarks. I'm now going to turn it over to Mark and Dave.
Hi, good afternoon, Mayor, Commissioners. My name is Mark Williams. I'm the Private for Hire Program Manager.
And good afternoon, Mayor and Commissioners. My name is Dave Benson. I'm the Parking Group Manager at PBOT. So I appreciate Director Treats and Commissioner Novick's introductory comments. It's been said, but it's worth been repeating that the changes here before you today have been guided by a lot of work from a lot of people, the Innovation Task Force, a million rides, the data that we were able to derive out of those rides, your input, an evolving market, and providing a safe service for the consumer, and doing so and adopting regulations and our recommendations that are fair and equitable, we believe, to the providers. Commissioner Novick mentioned it, but it is a cornerstone of the private for hire service, of citywide service, and it requires service 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, throughout the city, and it also requires that both taxi and TNC operators must accommodate all requests for service for wheelchair accessible vehicles. Permit caps. Prior to the pilot in April of this year, the private for hire board had the ability to cap the number of private for hire vehicles in the city of Portland, and they rarely granted exceptions to that. We're proposing that there's no caps on the number of vehicles a company can permit, similar to what's been going on during the pilot. This way, companies can have as many vehicles as they want, and the market will determine the appropriate number of private for hire vehicles. Fares. Prior to the pilot, the city had a long list of mandated fare requirements. Our proposed change, similar to what's been happening in the pilot, is there's no mandated fares, but we're requiring the companies to establish base fares, report them to us, and they have to be approved by the director prior to implementation. All the fares have to be made in a way that's readily available and clear and transparent to the consumer. And while dynamic pricing is allowed during emergencies declared by the mayor, they can be suspended and they're never allowed for wave services.
Before you leave that, Dave, just maybe a quick sketch. That is, the base fare rates are submitted to the director for approval. What criteria are there for why you might turn down a fare rate? In other words, if we're partially or significantly deregulating fares, when would you say, no, that fare schedule is unacceptable and here's why?
Well, it's so that the Bureau can be fully informed of what's going on in the market. Mm-hmm. We wouldn't turn down a fare rate. They are deregulated. But we're also suggesting there will be an advisory board, and they would also be informed of what a company or companies are proposing. So it's part of that connection of a fair and transparent rate structure.
These fares include base, you say base fares, but also peak fares?
Dynamic pricing.
Yeah.
Dynamic pricing, as you know, is when it's a Friday or Saturday night, late in the night, especially the TNCs raise their fares to adjust for the demand in the marketplace.
And would those also be submitted?
No.
Okay, just, only the base fares.
Just the base fares.
Okay.
It says all fare rates are made available to the
consumer
in a clear and transparent way. What does that mean?
So when you bring up on your app for
no, Uber, no, I'm talking about a taxi. How do I know what the taxi is?
The taxis have the rates or have had the rates, and we expect they will in the future posted in the cabs of what the rates are.
So literally I have to go down the line to ask them what their rate is before I get into the
cab. Yeah, that's one of the issues. I would imagine when you call for a ride, you could ask and ask them what their rates are. To be competitive, I would expect, I don't know, but I would expect many of the taxi companies would adopt a similar rate structure. But yes, I mean, there will be some variation.
And I won't know if I'm not calling. I have to call.
Well, if you're calling to ask for a cab, you can, and hopefully they're posted in the cab. When the cab arrives, you could certainly ask the driver what the rates are.
You know, this may be far-fetched, but I'm the guy that always goes to the bar thinking I'm going to take advantage of happy hour, but I'm 2 minutes past the expiration of happy hour, so I get the regular menu prices. So is it when you book the trip or when you get in the car that determines whether you're covered by the established pricing or the dynamic pricing?
Well, it's for the app, I think the dynamic pricing is indicated when you book the trip. At least I can say that's with the Uber app. I've seen that. You know that when you're in dynamic pricing, it will actually tell you your price is going to be between a dollar amount. In a cab, though, we expect you to have it posted so the consumer can see that when they get in the car.
But I want to be clear on this point. If you're using an app and you reserve a Lyft, but it takes 20 minutes to get there, can they charge you a higher rate because you've now into a period of time in which dynamic pricing kicks in, or are they bound by whatever the price was at the time that you engage them?
That's a good question. I'm not sure if I know the answer to that one.
Right. We should ask the industry when they come up, but my understanding is when you book the ride at that time, you are locking in the rate when you request the ride.
Actually, Commissioner, we need to make sure that is the rule. I mean, if we need any sort of clarification on that in our rules, then we will make it and specify exactly what you just said.
Just going back to my line of questioning, for those of us who are going to want to continue to use taxis, there's not going to be any limit on the number of taxi cab companies, right? Anybody can come right in and get taxis. So is there going to be any centralized place that will post what the base rates of each taxi company is, or do I have to call through all of them?
Yeah, if you know, you probably call the one you normally call and you know what their rates are, I would suspect, but there will be no requirement from us to have a centralized bulletin board or anything else that lists the prices.
Why not? If we're trying to make it so that people like me can still not happen to pick a cab at the most expensive taxi company, why would the city not have some responsibility to help consumers find out what the prices are?
If that's Commissioner, the city doesn't, I mean, governments don't generally do that for prices of most things.
Governments generally, in the past in Portland, have regulated the price of taxis. So now we're not.
The way I look at it, Commissioner, is the same. We have dynamic pricing in hotels. We have dynamic pricing for airlines. We have dynamic pricing for a lot of things in the marketplace. And you do have to be a consumer and shop. And I think that would apply to taxis as well.
Thank you. Let's go forward.
Accessible service. Prior to the pilot, 20% of the vehicle fleet must be wheelchair accessible. What we're proposing is that we move from a percentage of the fleet to a performance metric, so all companies are required to reasonably accommodate persons with disabilities, including individuals with mobility devices and those accompanied by service animals. They have to provide 24-hour service. And the services, again, based upon wait times. And the line we've established is a 30-minute time. Wait time is a rebuttable proposition of unacceptable service.
So one of the issues that came up last time when we had this conversation was that a service standard doesn't provide universal access if the app doesn't require that everybody who seeks a vehicle gets service. And it was the example of people in East County trying to reserve a car and being told there were no cars available. So what is the mechanism you're building in to make sure that everybody is reasonably accommodated and no one is essentially redlined from accessing the service?
And I think Commissioner Novick, in his introductory comments, talked about that. The industry has been doing a good job moving that way, but they're not there yet. And we're going to have to work with the industry to ensure they are in compliance. And if they're not in compliance, you know, take the appropriate enforcement actions to help them bring in compliance. One of the issues for the industry is finding or having enough way vehicles to accommodate most all requests. Now, is there going to be a time during the day or during special events when, you know, taxis and TNCs, private for hire vehicles, are just not available at all? I think that we would say that would probably be true. But our metric is for most all occasions that a WAVE vehicle would always be accessible.
David, I mean, the way to do that is simply, which I thought we were doing actually, although I can't cite chapter and verse, is that the assumption will be that if you get a message saying nothing is available, then that will be treated as you're being beyond the 30 minutes.
Yes. I mean, we have some of that. I mean, it's if we get a message on the app, if that's what you're talking about, that a WAVE vehicle is not accessible or not available, that yes, they're not in compliance.
Right. That is treated as a violation. It's treated as if they waited, they showed up 30 minutes later, more than 30 minutes later.
Oh, man, lost one. We've heard from providers that the higher cost of providing accessible transportation is a barrier to providing WAVE service. This new revision allows the director to establish a fund for the purposes of providing an incentive for private for hire WAVE service. The stated goal of the fund would to help the providers mitigate the higher cost of providing WAVE service. I think council recalls hearing testimony about the cost of providing WAVE service, and we heard that, and that's what this fund is would be designed to do. We think, and later in the presentation you'll hear about establishing a private for hire advisory committee. We think this is going to be one of their first jobs to conduct research and to recommend a fee rate to the director so we could establish this fund.
Just a philosophical question. This fund is intended to compensate people for the, or create incentives to offset the higher cost of complying with the WAVE service. But Commissioner Novick, we had raised together at one point the question about what about taxi companies who have already made that investment in fleets that are now arguably at a competitive disadvantage. Are we contemplating compensating them?
We actually had asked the taxi companies to collectively to give us data on how many had recently made purchase of WAVES, like recently before the rules changed, and we've gotten somewhat spotty response to that request. I would still be open to the idea of pursuing something like that if we had the right. I mean, I think that's something that we can take up later on. We have been struggling to get the appropriate data.
And what's the uses of the fund? Who does it go to?
What we anticipate is, as we envision it, that we'd have a fund of proceeds from rides. We'd probably charge an additional few cents a ride, and that we would divide that amongst the providers that have given retail WAVE rides. There is lots of discussion about the actual cost of providing a WAVE ride. What is a a WAVE ride compared to a non-emergency medical transportation that's reimbursed to the providers at a different rate. So this is all work the advisory committee would do to determine what that fee should be and then how it would be divided and the criteria for dividing it amongst the providers.
And when you say providers, do you mean the actual drivers?
No, I'm talking about, well, that's a good question. I think we're talking about the companies that provide the service.
I think that's a problem, because then the drivers are still disadvantaged if they're providing the extra time to help folks needing a little more time to get into the vehicle. It was my understanding that then they would get compensated for that.
And nothing in this code prevents that. I think that would, again, that's good feedback to the advisory committee to help develop a structure for moving forward.
So do I need to make an amendment to this code in order to allow that to happen?
I don't think so. There's nothing that prevents it from happening.
Well, I'm not clear as to why we would be giving additional compensation to the company. They either have the vehicles or they don't.
But buying the vehicles cost money. So in effect, you are compensating them for the fact that they've made this additional purchase in order to be able to provide this service.
The taxi companies have already done that. Are you saying we're going to subsidize the TNCs to get more vehicles that the taxi companies already have?
Well, actually, we'll be subsidizing the taxi companies for their past purchases, which we don't do now. Right now, they don't get any additional money for WAVE rides. They're simply required to buy the WAVE vehicles. From now on, whenever they give a WAVE ride, they will be paid more money. And what the TNCs are doing is they're contracting with people with WAVE vehicles in order to get the ride, so they're paying for that too. So basically, we go from a situation where we required the taxis to have a certain number of WAVE vehicles and didn't compensate them for that in any way to a system where we are compensating for the additional cost of WAVE rides on a per-ride basis.
So that would, in fact, address Commissioner Fish's concern about companies that have already made the investment. They then get a higher per-ride fee when they use those vehicles.
They will. One reason, though, that I'm still receptive to Commissioner Fish's suggestion is that you don't know that the companies that recently bought a bunch of WAVE vehicles will get that many requests for WAVE service. So if, say, Green Cab has a bunch of WAVE vehicles, but they never get calls for WAVE service, then they would never get reimbursed. So that's why I think that it might be reasonable to shoehorn Commissioner Fish's concept into this structure.
And why would a transportation network company get more money for having independent drivers who have accessible vehicles when they're required to provide their service anyway?
Well, we're trying to, this is the same argument could be applied to the taxis. I mean, what we're doing is acknowledging that we are imposing a requirement on this industry of providing WAVE rides, which does cost extra money. And it seems reasonable to us to set up a system where that's acknowledged and where anybody who is having to pay the additional cost of providing WAVE rides gets some compensation.
Well, so I would encourage the committee to look at, yes, certainly if the TNC is contracting with a company, then that is an appropriate use of the compensation. If they have private drivers who have accessible vehicles, it doesn't seem reasonable that the TNC should get that money. It seems like the owner of the vehicle should get the money.
Okay.
Can I just follow up on one other item? The private for hire transportation advisory board that you're referring to, when do you intend to constitute that body?
That's a good question that I can't answer.
Soon after the rules are established, we would have to identify the folks as contemplated in the code and bring them together, I would think, sometime after the first of the year.
So we are disbanding the existing oversight body?
Correct.
And we are disbanding the task force?
Yes, task force already been disbanded.
Okay. And so is it currently anticipated that you would bring nominees to the council for approval?
I don't think the language currently reads that way. I think the nominees are brought to the director for approval.
Commissioner Novick, in light of some of the controversy we've had about composition of the task force and the sunsetting of the existing body, I would request that whatever the criteria is and the nominees come to council for approval.
I have no problem with that.
That might need to be an amendment, but we'll get back to that. Okay. You just got some more slides in your presentation,
yeah,
so let you continue with those, Dave.
So driver background checks. Prior to the pilot, the city conducted background checks, and the city conducted driver checks. The criminal background checks were through the law enforcement data system, and they used that. We used that portal to access the National Crime Information Center, and then the driving records were conducted through Oregon DMV, and for out-of-state driving records, we have to use it through LEDS. On October 15th of this year, we received a letter from the Department of State Police, who are charged with interpreting the state statutes relating to the use of the data system and through that, the NCIC, or National Crime Information Center. In short, our request to continue using those systems are denied. Last time I was in council, I heard Commissioner Fritz, and I appreciate her desire to have government conduct these background checks through governmental systems. In part, that's why I spoke on multiple occasions to the Department of State Police as recently as yesterday. I spoke to the head of the division that manages this, Tom Worthy, and he acts, and his division acts as the gatekeeper for the law enforcement data system. He asked me to pass along to you and to council that the state of Oregon has adopted federal guidelines for security practices written by the FBI. And as you know, that data security is a top priority for government and private business as well. So it's no surprise that security of these systems, not only here in Oregon, but around the country, is a big issue. However, we think we have an acceptable alternative to that that is very good. The background checks shall be performed by a third party accredited by the National Association of Professional Background Screeners. I will tell you that I know many law enforcement agencies use this tool on an ongoing basis to supplement their criminal investigations, and it's been very helpful. The companies can opt to have the city run the background checks on their drivers for a fee, or they can conduct their own, and if they conduct their own, we'll require them to maintain records, and the city will audit these records.
How often and how many of the records will be audited?
We'll do some random audits. In terms of how many compliance audits, and Mark's going to talk about that, but in the hundreds of audits per year for these companies running these background checks, we will quickly transition to what we call targeted auditing, because random audits get random results, and if you know there's a problem or problems out there, we'll do targeted auditing of companies to make sure that they're complying with the rules. Like I said, very quickly we'll know if there's problems or there's some lack of understanding of what needs to happen.
And what's the standard for when we would, and what are the penalties for, you know, how many do, if they come back that they didn't do it properly, what's then the penalty for that?
Sure. So we have some penalties outlined. We did revise some of the penalties, but we will, the companies are required to submit a list of all the vehicles and all their drivers that they onboard to the service, or the vehicle or the drivers that they're actually permitting. We handle this the same way with the TNCs right now, and we audit their driver's list and their vehicle information as well. And when we do file a final violation, we can issue a warning. We can also issue civil penalties as well. But we do and plan to use the same process to monitor any of the taxi companies that choose to go ahead and provide their own background services through one of the approved providers.
That really didn't answer my question.
Sorry.
How many times do we need to find a company has not done a proper background check, or that there is issues that come up that the background check missed? At what point do we say that they can't continue to operate or that they have to have the city do their background checks?
Sure. I think if we issue a warning the first time and a civil penalty the second time, if they can't seem to figure it out, maybe we take that privilege away from them and we do it.
And do I need to make that as an amendment?
I don't think so, Commissioner. That the civil penalties are described in code, and we have no problem issuing civil penalties, nor in consultation with the director revoking a permit to operate. If we have a company that's not conducting appropriate background checks, we certainly have not only the ability to do that, we would do that.
So could you direct me to the section of the code that I should be looking at?
Doing it right now?
That's what we're looking at right now.
Thank you.
Go on with the presentation, though, while you do that, please.
Sure. I thought you might want to know some of the disqualifying factors for background checks. It's a variety of criminal history and traffic infractions and traffic crimes. Any felony conviction clearly in the preceding 10 years, although it's not listed here, any felony conviction involving the use or threat of physical harm, no matter when it occurred, would be a disqualifying factor. Greater than 5 traffic infractions, if the driver's permit was revoked by the director, if the driver is a match on the National Sex Offender Public Registry, are all reasons that we would that applicant would not qualify for a permit, and clearly if the driver is under 21 years
old. Where would a DUI fall within those categories?
It would be driving privileges that were revoked, and we use that broadly, suspended or revoked within the last 3 years. A DUI would clearly fit into that category.
Does the individual driver have a permit that we issue?
Yeah, the driver has to go through and obtain a city business license, and they have to go through this process.
So we're going to be issuing a private for hire permit?
Not specifically. We're going to issue, they have to get a city business license that we can clearly identify they've been through this process.
So then what does this third from the bottom bullet mean, that in the preceding years the driver's permit was revoked by the director?
Existing permittees.
Existing. Right. So if a driver, for whatever reason, had a number of violations where we actually revoked their permit, okay, within the last 3 years, they would not be able to reapply.
But they're not getting a permit under the new system.
Right. We wouldn't certify them.
I'm not following how a driver in a TNC gets to be told that they can't drive anymore.
If they don't meet the requirements within the code, the parameters of the code, they're not legal to drive.
But to Commissioner Fritz's question, I think that the rule should be the same going forward for people who are operating because they're authorized to be in a platform and have a business license as for previously for people who had permits. So we should be sure that it's clear that if you were told that you had to get off the platform or otherwise have your privileges suspended, then you're not allowed back in for 3 years.
And Commissioner, forgive us. Choice of language, what the new code says is certification, and that's what this slide should have said.
So
but the effect is the same.
We are going to certify every driver.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Would you like to, sorry for interrupting, if you'd like to return back to your previous question about the fees and fines, the current, it starts in, it's Chapter 16, 40.930 civil penalties and the penalty table. And if you were looking at the same document, it starts on a page 142.
Thanks.
And perhaps assuming a question that you're going to ask or had alluded to previously, the proposed regulations have a series of fees and fines. There's a first offense, a second offense, and then subsequent offenses. And revocation of permits or certification can be revoked by the director under stipulated reasons. So if you do want, that would require a change to the code. If you want that to be after a certain offense, if you want it to be revoked, that would have to be changed.
Thank you.
Welcome. Should we go ahead with, should we?
Please. Ira Tran. Yep. Within 30 days of certification, new drivers have to complete a driver-approved training course that's going to contain relevant city code provision, administrative rules. We have a great opportunity to educate these drivers on Vision Zero principles of traffic safety. They'll have to know about Portland area attractions and have customer service training.
How long do you envision this training being?
Well, in the past, the driver's training, they've been allowed 1 hour, if you're talking about the amount of time they've been given to take the test.
That's then, the test. That's not the training.
Right.
We're going to go through all this in an hour?
Yes.
So I would suggest that we've got a real opportunity here for 2,000-plus additional drivers to get more education on how to be a good driver. When I lived in New York, I took a defensive driving course, which was, I think, 8 hours long because it got me a 10% discount on my insurance. Mm-hmm. And it was excellent. And I think it's changed the way I've driven ever since. So if we really are committed to Vision Zero and we have this group of folks who want to be employed as drivers, it seems like we could require them to take an outside defensive driving course as part of one of the requirements for being on the platform.
Just to be clear, it's not the test was supposed to be completed in an hour. That doesn't mean that the training is only supposed to be an hour, right?
Yes, thank you for clarifying. So the presumption is that the employer will be made aware of all of the requirements for their drivers, and then they will be given a test that will be tested on those requirements within which they have an hour to complete that test.
So the companies will be providing this education?
Correct.
And we don't know what that looks like?
Once they determine what they're going to, they basically have to send their test to us for approval. We get to see everything that they're administering on their test.
Thank you.
To make sure that all these items are covered.
And they then certify that people have passed the test.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Vehicle inspections. Talk a little bit about that. Prior to the pilot, every private for hire vehicle had to have an annual ASE, which is Automotive Service Excellence inspection by an approved master mechanic. In the proposed changes, it'll require an annual ASE inspection by approved mechanic or approved Blue Seal shop. And all the vehicles will be required to have a fire extinguisher, first aid kit, and hands-free device. Vehicle identification. Every taxi cab must prominently display on both sides of the vehicle the following. They have unique colors of their company, the name of the taxi cab company, the company assigned taxi number, the telephone number where they can request a service, and the word taxi cab or taxi cab. In contrast, the TNCs must have trade dress signage clearly visible from the front and rear of the vehicles from a distance of 20 feet and has to be placed on the interior or exterior of the vehicles.
Well, that's different from the present practice of TNCs, right? There's nothing in the rear.
Correct. Many TNCs, there is nothing in the rear. I have seen some out there with the rear, but we're asking them to have it both front and rear.
Okay. And then for the taxis, the color, I mean, is it really... Why do we care? What color?
Typically, all the taxi cab companies are required to have a unique design so all of their cabs look identical. And when we have a new taxi company enter the city once approved, we do, as part of that approval process, we look at their color scheme to make sure that it's unique and doesn't match any of the existing companies permitted.
But if you have like an overlying, you can have a logo. I can understand having a unique logo, but can't that be overlain or underlain by different colors of the vehicles?
I would imagine that prior to this existing or to the new code, that I think that maybe the private for hire board probably approved that. It's some time to go. I'm not really privy to the history as to why we have that requirement.
We didn't contemplate changing it or opening to, that would be something you'd like to see change, we don't have objection to that. I don't, there's, okay. It just carried over from the previous code.
Yeah, well, I was talking with a representative from EcoCab this morning or this afternoon, and I think it's their desire to have use Teslas, and I think Teslas are hard to come by, but they can, if you can broaden the color spectrum, I think it makes it easier for them to secure more vehicles, but they would keep their same EcoCab logo, but it just could be a different colored vehicle. So I would just flag that as sort of a flexibility we should allow.
I think, you know, and this standard is years old. I think the standard was so you could tell one cab company from another, and I think that you see the same thing across the country. So,
Commissioner, the Oregon Ducks football team would not be allowed to establish a taxi company because they change their colors every week.
Yeah, really every game.
Hales, taxis have the exclusive right to queue in designated taxi stands, of which there are 46 around the city, and may accept street hails to include from hotel zones. And clearly, in contrast, TNCs cannot accept street hails and may only accept rides through an affiliated TNC app. And the reasons for that is that color scheme, the ability to have a taxi light, and that cabs are required to have that internal camera system, so when they have somebody hail them and get into the cab who is a stranger to them, there's some sense of security for that driver. Clearly, one of the most challenging issues has been the development of regulations governing the insurance requirements for this industry. We're recommending the following: general commercial liability insurance with limits of at least $1 million per occurrence and $2 million in aggregate, auto insurance with limits of at least $500,000 per occurrence. The TNCs, we're recommending $1 million in general commercial liability and $2 million in aggregate. And in period one, and just to revisit period one, that's when a driver has the app on, but they have not accepted a ride or have a passenger in the car. We're recommending $50,000 in death, injury per person, $100,000 per incident, and $25,000 in property damage. In periods two and three, in periods two is when the driver is accepted a ride from a passenger and is en route to pick the passenger up. And period three is when they have the passenger or passengers in the vehicle. $1 million in death, personal injury, and property damage per incident. $1 million under an uninsured motorist coverage for death, personal injury, and property damage per incident.
If I have an amendment on this, would now be a good time
Let's,
to
let's let them get through the presentation, okay. And then we'll get to amendments. I've got some questions.
Advisory committee, pre-pilot, I think I've already talked a little bit about this. The board had rules for the for-hire transportation industry in Portland. We're recommending the private for-hire advisory committee. It's a community advisory body representing those with interest in the private for-hire transportation in the city of Portland. They'd be charged with monitoring the industry and making recommendations, providing feedback to the public, director, and city council on the private for hire market. They could make recommendation for changes in code, administrative rules, and monitoring us, PBOT, as we enforce the code and regulations for effectiveness. Data reporting, prior to the pilot, taxi drivers were required to keep a log. During the pilot and our recommended changes is that we want to keep data including date and time of trips, the time and date of unfulfilled requests, the trip origin, trip destination, trip wait time, trip duration. This is critical information. It informs us about the private for hire business generally. If it's growing, if it's shrinking, over time we'll get a sense of the seasonal impacts, gaps in service, especially for wave service trends. It'll help and advise the advisory committee and council and us about what's going on in this industry and what rules or policies need to be changed to address them. While we haven't had a lot of data yet, we have we're 6 months into our second in total into the pilots. Over time, we'll have nearly contemporaneous information and much historical data to really advise and give us information so we can make those changes going forward, and we think it's a critical component to the work we do. Fees and the program cost recovery, we talked a little bit about this. For the renewals, a taxi company had to pay between $500 and $3,000 a driver every time they renewed every year, $100. And to renew a cab, it was $600. What we're proposing going forward is a 50-cent ride fee. Commissioner Saltzman was already thanked, but I'll thank him again for coming up with that suggestion, because we explored a whole number of models for cost recovery, and as it turned out, this was, in our view, the best. The 50-cent ride fee is simply to recover the cost of personnel and materials and services to regulate the taxis and TNCs. We feel is the fairest and most equitable way to handle our expenses, and allows the providers to pass their costs directly through to the consumer on a receipt labeled City of Portland surcharge. This relieves these providers and their drivers of shouldering the annual renewal fees, which we've heard about as being burdensome, and we hope improves their profit margin. As we continue collecting ride data, we'll measure our expenses against the number of trips originating in Portland and make adjustments annually. If we collect too much money, we'll establish a set-aside and use those excess monies to help pay our expenses and adjust this surcharge downward.
So that then the waive fees on top of that?
Yes, that would be something that would come with an advisory committee, and they would recommend a fee. But, yes, that would
set
be
the on level
huh?
that they would set, or they would recommend a level for that fee?
Correct.
So we'll continue to conduct random compliance checks in which we will review the driver's background, criminal history, as well as their DMV records. The companies choose to use a third-party private background or third-party checker. They must be accredited by the National Association of Professional Background Screeners, and we'll be checking for that as well. We'll also make sure that each driver has a valid business license, and the PBOT may choose to run additional background checks on these drivers through another third-party provider accredited by the association, just to make sure that the information that we're getting is the same as the taxi cab companies or TNCs.
Does a TNC have to have a valid Oregon driver's license?
A valid driver's license, not necessarily Oregon.
Okay, and so for the TNCs that are operating in Portland under, let's say, a Washington driver's license, Washington plates, does that complicate our enforcement in any way?
Not necessarily, no, it does not. If I'm understanding your question, we will still enforce, we will still check for compliance audits on all the drivers that are onboarded onto the system.
But it is possible that the law and the liability and other things will change once you cross a state border, right?
Sure. I probably would need to check with the TNC companies to make sure that when they have a driver that is in Washington authorized to drive in Oregon through their platform, we need to make sure that they are on that approved list so that we can certify those drivers. So we may need to have that conversation to make sure we're handling that right logistically.
Well, I've seen a lot of TNCs downtown with Washington plates, so I'm assuming that they have complied with all of our regulations.
Sure. Yes, they do, Commissioner, and I think we'd have to check in with Ken McGarrett to make sure, but I don't perceive anything. I mean, they come through the normal onboarding process just like an Oregon driver would. Their cars have to meet Oregon emission standards. So I feel confident that they are, but I think it's a good question, and we can certainly check on it.
And if somebody comes up from California, like we had somebody who testified that she used to live in San Francisco and just decided to come up here, are they automatically on the platform up here, or do they have to then go through our process as well?
They will have to go through, anybody who's driving on the platform in the city of Portland is going to have to go through the Portland certification process. And we do random audits of all the driver certifications that are provided to us by the TNCs, and then we enforce randomly in the field.
And how do they know that whether somebody's driven up from San Francisco for the weekend and wants to do some moonlighting?
It's a question I would ask the TNCs of how they capture that data on their app.
Well, it would come into our compliance, right? Because if we don't know that those drivers are here, then there's no way we can audit them.
But we would enforce in the field and catch them that way. You're welcome.
I don't know if this is the right place to ask this question, but you know, we've been hearing a lot about vehicle recalls lately by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, and you know, and lawsuits against GM. So what if a vehicle is recalled and it's